Okay. Thank you for I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to come and talk at this, I think, rather broad-spectrum conference. I've looked through. I think I'm the only person who's going to be talking about some computational complexity theory topics, which are completely different in flavor from what we've been hearing about all morning. So this talk is structured more as a, I hope, rapid, somewhat pedagogical introduction to complexity theory, at least at the level of why physicists interested in glassy or slow phenomena should be interested in it. That's the first part of my talk. And then I'll tell you a little bit about some of the things that, you know, physics has said back to complexity theory over the last 30 years, and in particular to quantum complexity theory in the last few years, which hopefully I'll get to. That's where I've done some work recently. So, right. I also want to say, for anybody who's sort of a glass aficionado, that in this talk I'm taking a very broad view of what constitutes glassiness versus spin glassiness, this sort of thing. I'm just sort of looking for reasons that we could expect a system to have a hard time equilibrating, that its timescales for doing anything would be very long. Okay? So what is complexity theory? This is my lightning introduction. Complexity theory classifies problems according to the scaling of the resources a computer requires to solve large instances. So this is supposed to illustrate, as I make a piece of, so this I'm thinking of some kind of Ising model or something that I want to know the ground state of, and I make the piece of it bigger, I need to do more work to find it. This is something I keep in the back of my head as a model problem. And so as I make it bigger, the computer had to get bigger, I had to do more work. We heard right at the beginning of John Martinez's talk, something like that. So here, large, this is scaling as the instances get very big, so it's sort of the physics notion of thermodynamic. Right, yeah. That's what I want to say. So it's sort of easy to figure out, or easy now that there's been 50 years of research in it, to decide what will be a robust classification. So we want to classify problems, and the first thing is it's relatively easy to say what an easy problem is in this sense. It's going to be a problem which is solvable quickly, right? And in particular, it's going to be solvable, well, for this class P that you've probably heard of, solvable in polynomial time by a classical computer. That's what P means. And this is going to be distinguished from things that aren't solvable in polynomial time, so things that would take, you know, you might expect exponential time. These are things that are really hard to solve. You have to search through everything. And in the quantum world, we also have this rather newer complexity class known as BQP, which is bounded error quantum polynomial. So the idea is completely analogous to the classical complexity class P, except for now we allow our quantum computer, which is doing the work for us, to exploit quantum mechanics and this parallelism that we heard about, or whatever that means. Okay, so it's relatively easy to identify easy problems. We just need to find a polynomial time algorithm which solves them. So as a couple of examples, what is the energy of a given configuration in an Ising model is something that if I give you the configuration and I give you the Hamiltonian, you can evaluate. It's arithmetic. I date it to 500 AD because that's about when we figured out how to do positional arithmetic and figured out how to multiply efficiently. So in the quantum case, an example of a BQP problem, which is a bit less trivial, is this question, is there a non-trivial factor of an integer n, which famously Peter Shor solved, could be showed in 94, could be solved in polynomial time if you have quantum mechanics at your disposal. Okay. So now we want to identify what are hard problems. I want to tell you about hardness and what would make things slow. So first, we need to sort of restrict our attention to reasonable problems that we could hope to say anything about. And that's sort of what these two classes, NP and QMA, are about. You've probably at some point or another heard the term NP. This has been around a while. This means the class of problems which are checkable in polynomial time by a classical computer. QMA is the analogous quantum class, only much more recently defined. These are really big classes of problems. But they're also ones that, you know, are sort of reasonable. It's a bit funny when you're a physicist and you look at this and you say, why would I want to, you know, define these classes of problems by whether I can check them? But actually, it's sort of natural. They're problems about which, well, you could have any hope of believing a solution if somebody claimed they had figured it out. If I can't check it in efficiently, if I can, so check means somebody claims, here's the answer, it's yes, and here's my proof. And I need to check that proof. And if the proof is astronomically huge, I can't do it. So I have no reason to believe them, right? And in reality, they wouldn't be able to construct it either because it's astronomically huge. So this is a very large abstract class, but it has sort of all of the reasonable problems you might want. And some natural ones in physics are things like, is the ground state energy of that icing model below some threshold? Because now it's not, I'm not claiming that I can find the ground state energy, but if somebody can find the ground state and give it to me and says, yes, indeed, this Ising model has an energy below E, they just give me a state and I evaluate it using the algorithm I showed you on the previous slide, and I can check it. Right? So this is checkable, although perhaps not solvable easily. Right? And QMA is a completely analogous idea, except for now I need a quantum computer even to do the check, to do the verification. So this gives me a little bit more power because a quantum computer is a little bit more powerful than the classical computer. And the prototypical example is completely analogous. It's going to be, is the ground state energy of some local Hamiltonian below some threshold? There's some technical caveats, but let me leave it at that. Now the problem is this is a quantum Hamiltonian. Even if somebody could figure out the ground state, they couldn't hand it to me classically in general. It's too many amplitudes. If I have an n qubit system, it's 2 to the n amplitudes. So they can't give it to me classically. I need a quantum computer even for them to tell me the proof, which is this ground state, whose energy I want to evaluate. And so thus this is a larger class. Okay. So now let's understand this very simple point, which is that this conjecture that P doesn't equal NP is actually just the statement that there are hard problems, right? So, I mean, you can read about it and you can see why computer scientists think that P doesn't equal NP. This is an outstanding, math problem. Clay Institute Prize is out there for it. And in fact, there was a big claim 2 weeks ago that somebody, Vijay something or other, posted a new proof that P doesn't equal NP, and the internet has been tearing it up for the last few weeks. So you can go and read about it. It's sort of fun. And actually, it's an interesting proof because it makes use of a bunch of the ideas of spin glass theory, which I'm going to get to in the next part of this talk. So anyway, P doesn't equal NP. It's a conjecture. All it really means is there are hard problems. Okay? There are problems which we really can't just solve in some efficient way. Okay? And once you have quantum computers, it actually doesn't change very much. You might not write it as P doesn't equal NP, but there are hard problems even with quantum computers is, I think, still the working conjecture. This is some diagram of how these different complexity classes are supposed to fit together. Quantum polynomial is bigger than polynomial. QMA is bigger than NP. Quantum polynomial probably is a little bit disjointed, sticks out a little bit. But anyway, this is the picture, and this picture is actually more or less that statement. Okay. So, okay, that's as much general sort of acronyms and complexity theory I want to throw at you. Why is this physical? Why should we care? Okay. So now the strong Church-Turing hypothesis, which, you know, is just that, it's a hypothesis. I've paraphrased this way as, a computer can efficiently simulate any physical model of computation. Okay, and I'm including quantum in this. Okay? So all physical models of computation are equivalent, because if I can do something with one model or one computer, I can do it with the other computer by simulating the first one. Any physical object undergoing natural dynamics can be viewed as a computer because it does something. It has an input state and it transforms in some way and gives me an output. In fact, a computer is some physical object, but here I'm turning that on its head. I'm saying I just want to interpret the, the physical behavior of the system as doing a computation for me. Okay? And so then if I buy this, and if P doesn't equal NP, there must be glassy physical systems in the sense that the physical system can't find its ground state, because that would encode the solution to some problem that we think is hard. Okay? So all I told you so far was that we think there are hard problems. How can I find a particular problem which I can map into a physical system, which then would make me expect that that physical system would have slow dynamics? So this comes to the, yeah. Sure. So classical is a little less than quantum, but I'm taking physical as actually broader, quantum, whatever is physical. So yes, there are two models, there's classical and quantum, that we have now. If you go, and I'll come to it in a minute actually, if you go and look to the perhaps zanier parts of this argument, you find people who take the principle that NP-complete problems can't be solved by any physical system as a way to find new theorems about what nature could do beyond quantum mechanics, right? Restrictions on it. So I'll say a few words about that. But yes, that's right. In the usual theory, we separate classical and quantum, and they're different, or they seem to be different, unless there's big collapses, unless this isn't true. Yeah, as opposed to exponential or something like that. Okay. So how do we get to a specific problem that might be of interest to physicists? Well, we do what complexity theorists, what computer scientists do. We label them as guilty by association. Okay. So we basically identify particular hard problems by circumstantial evidence, which is to say that we can turn any problem in NP into an example of this particular sort of this particular kind of hard problem. So what I've written up here are some physics examples, which is that I can take on the classical side all classical verifiable problems and reduce them to finding the ground state energy of just a 3D Ising glass, 3D Ising model with plus or minus interactions on a lattice. Okay. This is what's known as an NP-complete problem, because it has this property that if I can solve it in general, I could solve everything in NP, and I don't think I can do that. We don't think that, in fact, there's a general purpose way to do that. So then that means that this 3D Ising glass problem is hard. And if I had one, it wouldn't be able to find its ground state. Okay? And in the quantum world, let's shift, it's almost the same thing. All quantum verifiable problems reduced to, and I've picked a nice example, this 2D Pauli glass, which is also, this is on a 2D lattice, and these interactions here are pairwise, but now those alpha, ij, and ji are just x, y, or z. They're labeling a particular Pauli operator that's going to act on a qubit on this lattice. Okay? Finding the ground state energy of this is QMA complete, QMA hard. So this result goes back to 1982, and this is a little more recent, 2005. Okay, so just to illustrate this again, let's take this argument to, yep. Yeah. Right. So the thing which is polynomial is to evaluate the energy of a state that's given to you, right? So if I said, is the energy of this state, and I told you up, down, less than 7, you could evaluate that energy and just say yes or no. Okay. What's hard here is I give you the model, the Hamiltonian, and I say, is there a state with energy less than something? And then you have to find the state. That's hard. So it's an important distinction, but it's sort of a subtle one. That's still a checkable problem. If I can find the state, I can check it. But it's no longer necessarily easy to evaluate. And in fact, this argument says that it shouldn't be easy to answer, because if I could answer it in general, I could answer any problem in this big class.
Yeah. Can you say something about the average versus most difficult case?
I'll get there. Yeah, don't worry. That's the second part. So, okay, let me keep going. So just to illustrate this argument, take it to its sort of strongest, most physical conclusion. Imagine this is some piece of 3D easing model with variable interactions. The claim is that no physical process can find the ground state of this Hamiltonian efficiently in general. Now, I should say, if we thought of this as a spin glass in the usual sense where we put IID random variables on the links or that sort of thing, this may not still be true. But in the general case, it's true. It might have correlated disorder in the physics language. But anyway, let's just go on with that. So in particular, I can't thermally anneal the system to find its ground state. It'll get stuck. I can't adiabatically anneal the system to find its ground state. This would be with a transverse field, because no process, whether it's quantum or classical, is going to find it. Okay, so let's just list a few complete problems. So this is NP or QMA complete problems. These are the hard problems that physicists may or may not be, well, may be familiar with or may like. So I've given you all ground state energy problems. That's how I like to think of them. So KSAT, which I'll define for you in a minute, is a prototypical example here. But then the more physics ones are things like Q-state POTS, 2D translation invariant tiling. So here, I don't even tell you the Hamiltonian I give you is a local constraint problem. It's completely regular on this 2D graph. It's translation invariant. It's still hard in an appropriate sense. The 3D easing glass with variable couplings, the planar easing glass in a field. Those are results going back to that paper in 82. And then more recently, there's been a bunch of quantum results. So QMA complete ground state energy problems, K-local Hamiltonian and KQSAT are sort of the prototypical examples. They're closely related to KSAT. This is satisfiability. But also more natural physics problems are the 2D polyglass. And the one which is sort of most amazing, it's not exactly QMA complete, but it's morally it is 1D translation invariant Hamiltonian, which is to say I give you a 1D Hamiltonian, which is translation invariant, its nearest neighbor. It has rather large particles, so it's not qubits. It's rather big local degrees of freedom, but finite. And finding the ground state energy of this is actually QMA complete. It's as hard as anything you could do. The only thing which is varying as I give you larger and larger examples of that is the size, and just saying it's a size 10 example or a size 20 example. So I think that's a pretty neat result from last year. Is the ground state less than some constant? Yeah. That's right. So let me say two more things about these physical consequences before I switch gears. There's a set of classical results. Now, this is a place where the classical models and the quantum models aren't in agreement yet. And in fact, it's open whether this will cross over. Is something called the PCP theorem, which is about the hardness of approximation. And this is actually a really amazing result, and I can't give it justice in a slide. But what it basically says is that I could guarantee you that I'm going to give you an example of a satisfiability problem, some constraint satisfaction problem, one of these optimization problems, where the example either has zero ground state energy, it's completely satisfiable, or it has an extensive energy in its ground state. That some macroscopic fraction in every state, some macroscopic fraction of the constraints will be unhappy. It's actually hard to determine which case I'm in. It's NP complete to determine that. And this actually tells you, that even finite annealing these systems to a finite temperature will get stuck. You don't even need to get all the way down to zero temperature. You ain't going to make it down to a finite temperature, because if I could anneal this down to a finite temperature, I would actually be able to get an energy a little bit, well, on this one, I'd get an energy perhaps below whatever this guarantee was, and then I'd actually be able to distinguish. So I can't even bring these things down a little bit, and in fact, the best result is that certain rather non-physical models, but still, the best result is that 3SAT in general can't be cooled to any finite temperature below infinite, which is a little bit silly. So I'll say there's a caveat here that these results really don't apply to the finite dimensional examples. 2 and 3D models typically don't have PCP theorems for them. But anyway, and the quantum PCP is an open question in this field. So, and then just this sort of, this comment is, this is, like I said, you can start with the statement, well, no physical process can solve NP complete problems in polynomial time. I'm not saying P particularly, just no physical process. And then you can ask, does that have implications about physics? And there's an enjoyable article by Scott Aronson from a few years back where he sort of goes through a lot of different potential modifications of quantum mechanics or strange things in gravity and so on, and basically says none of these are possible if you buy this as a physical principle, because you'd be able to solve hard problems. Which is, I mean, I don't know how seriously we should take this, but you know, it's interesting. Okay, so now it's remaining few minutes. Switch to sort of the other question, which is, what if physicists, statistical physics, physicists mostly said back to complexity theory? And here's this question about average versus worst case. So everything I just told you was about worst case hardness. Obviously, if I give you some example of a satisfiability problem, it may be easy. I give you a particular example of the 3D easing model. It's ferromagnetic. You look at it and you say, oh, the ground state is everything's down. Here's the energy, right? So what you know from the complexity theory result is that in the worst case, it's hard. And that gives you some idea of systems that if you study ensembles of, you should find glassiness if you pick the right ensembles, because somewhere in this phase space, there are hard examples. It also, like I said, it's sort of it's guilty by association of being hard. I can transform things into it. So now you want to turn around and say, well, what makes it hard in detail? And can I find mechanisms? Now this begins to get back to sort of the physical approach. And one of the things that has come out of this study is that when you study ensembles of these hard optimization problems, you find glassy regimes and also various glass transitions, clustering, that sort of thing. So let me tell you a little bit about this classically with this three-sat problem. Now, this model is the prototypical model for NP-complete problems, although this one looks less physical than some of the other ones, just happens to be more amenable to certain kinds of analysis. So here I have n bits. These are the green dots. I have m constraints. This is some kind of local constraint problem. I write a Hamiltonian, which is a sum of these constraints, these energy functions, which are basically, each one is saying, I penalize one out of the eight possible states which are connected to me. So this is a three-body interaction. Each of those red boxes is one of these constraints, and the green dots are the spins. And I want to know, is the ground state energy zero? That is there a state which satisfies simultaneously all the red boxes, all the constraints? I'll say it's sort of an easing model because it's two-state systems, but it's not really easing because it doesn't have the symmetry. And in this formulation, I haven't restricted it to being local in any geometric sense. I'm allowing the interactions to be long-ranged, right? That's something to keep in mind. I already told you that three-set is NP-complete, but let's ask about its average complexity. And that means I'm going to put an ensemble. I need to know what average means. I'm going to put an ensemble on this. And so I'm going to just pick random interactions. This is called random three-set. I pick random interactions on a random graph of some sort. I control that choice with a clause density. So I decide I want, one clause per spin or 1.2 clauses per spin, and then I randomly throw them down. And then I also have to disorder the couplings, which means randomly choosing which of the eight local states each of those red boxes penalizes. Right? And this gives me some model, which was, it's not exactly this model, but is one of the earliest models, which was given this kind of analysis back in the 80s. So this allows us to sort of ask which instances are hard. It gives us an ensemble of typical instances, some control parameters, and connects us to spin glass physics, at least of a Parisian type, which is to say spin glass physics following from replica symmetry breaking solutions, as carried out by Giorgio Parisi or his Paris-based colleagues. I'm going to quickly explain this picture. This is a phase diagram for, say, 3SAT, although I've clearly just drawn it as a cartoon. And this comes from, I mean, a lot of work dating over the last really 10 or 15 years of studying these optimization problems with something called the one-step replica symmetry breaking cavity method, which is really sort of an art at this point. They're really good at it. And what's interesting about this is that in this context, it seems pretty clear that the approximation, which is replica symmetry breaking, or goes into this analysis, is actually probably correct. And so this picture actually has some meaning, which may or may not carry over to, or what carries over to finite dimensional glassy systems is not clear. So anyway, let's just quickly go through this. I think it's a neat picture. Clearly, this alpha is my clause density. So at very low clause densities, I expect the system to be satisfiable. I haven't constrained it very much. And at very high clause densities, I expect it to be unsatisfiable because I've way over constrained it. And in between are these interesting transitions. So what these boxes are showing are sort of cartoons of phase space. Black means that's a solution. This is a solution in the hypercube of phase space. And in this regime here, there's one big black spot, which is most of phase space. So there's a giant cluster of solutions, which are all connected to each other by sort of small spin flips. You can walk between them. Okay? And then as you increase alpha, you get these transitions where the solution space actually fractures. And the idea of these separate dots is that two solutions in the same dot, actually you can walk between them with sort of small moves and without leaving the dot, or only very slightly at low energy cost, and come back. And two solutions in different dots actually require a macroscopic fraction of the spins to be flipped to get between them. So these are really separated. Okay. So this is the, it's this picture. It's just a cartoon. So this is, you know, I can say words, barrier to local search dynamics. This is pretty true. Algorithms don't behave well once you're in these regimes. And classical relaxation. In a more quantum context, if you try to solve these classical constraint satisfaction problems, these random ones, by applying a transverse field or doing something like the adiabatic algorithm, there's some recent arguments which basically exploit this clustering picture to argue that you will get very small gaps in the adiabatic algorithm. Okay. So I told you very quickly about these sort of classical things and a little bit how they connect to quantum. In the quantum world, there's this QMA completeness, so we know what the worst case hardness things are, but these questions aren't quite so real anymore. As of the last year or two, there's actually been a fair bit of work on trying to study random ensembles of QMA hard problems, quantum hard problems. And so now, you know, we have example systems where there's satisfiability transitions, that was sort of clear, but also I think an interesting entanglement transition, which is perhaps the first analogy of these clustering transitions that you saw in that cartoon in a quantum setting. Let me not talk about the algorithms. So I'm going to try in the last couple minutes to tell you about quantum satisfiability, which is a natural quantum generalization of that classical satisfiability problem that I just flashed through, and which is, in the worst case, QMA 1 complete. The 1 is, I can answer questions about later, but it's a detail. It's also quantum hard. And the question is, are the typical instances hard? Are they quantumly hard? Are they classically hard? Whatever that means. Can we find structure in that? So it's motivated by the classical story. Here's the model. This slide should look sort of familiar. Now, these green dots are qubits instead of plain old bits. The Hamiltonian is a sum of constraints that act on, well, the k local qubits. 3 was what I've drawn. And they're projectors. And they penalize 1 out of the 2 to the k local states, 1 out of the 8 local states. This is completely analogous to the classical model. In fact, if I set the projectors to be onto computational basis states, I would get back my classical model of ksat. Now, this problem, like I said, is QMA hard. What can we study in sort of the average case? Again, you can take the exact same ensemble of random graphs, This is a discrete choice, it's combinatorial. I lay down these interactions, I randomly place them, but now I have to choose what to penalize, and of course there's a local quantum Hilbert space, which I have to pick my projector in. So that's some kind of continuous choice that I need to make. Okay, now I'm gonna skip to the punchline, which is what's the phase diagram of this model as a function of clause density as we understand it, okay? And here there's a fair bit of stuff up there. So it's different for the different k's. This is also true in the classical case. I'll tell you very quickly, in the k equals 2 case, it's completely solved. There's a direct transition from the satisfiable phase to the unsatisfiable phase. You can, you know, really calculate where it is, everything. And it's not surprising that this is sort of easy here, because in fact, 2 QSAT is classically solvable even in the worst case. It's actually in P. It's only once K gets up to 3 or 4, so I have larger body interactions, that the problem becomes hard. Okay? That was for the quantum case, sorry. It's in P. No. 2 QSAT is in P, because you can actually analyze the problem. And let me explain that a little bit more. It's important. It's not only that it's in P and therefore I can analyze it all. It's in P because, and this is this prodsat business, that blue up there. It's not just satisfiable, but it is satisfiable by product states. And you can prove it. Okay? We've completely characterized the product states here. So if it's satisfiable by product states, actually somebody could tell you what the product state is, because the product state only has n complex numbers, basically. 2n if you forget normalization, but n complex numbers, linear number. And so you can actually evaluate the energy of a product state, and you can do it all classically, you just do some math. And this is part of why you can solve k equals 2. It still has some interesting structure, but you know, it's simpler. At larger k, the problem is, in the worst case, hard, and also the analysis becomes harder, and you can't make these sharp connections. In fact, we still characterized exactly where product states exist. This is this that color over there. So it's satisfiable at low clause densities, even for large k. It is satisfiable, that is, there's zero energy states, and they are product states, and you can characterize that. And that means you also know where they aren't product states anymore. Oh, okay, good. And in particular, the product state transition where they go away in k equals 3 is at this 0.92. And for large k, as k gets large, it goes to 1 from below. So this regime at low alpha is product satisfiable. Let me point out, this isn't actually trivial. This thing which is here is where the hypercore emerges in these graphs. So this is where it's actually a big connected up mess. At very low densities, random graphs fall apart into disconnected trees, and then they're not very interesting. But this is still actually non-trivial in that sense. So we can characterize product satisfiability. That tells us there's a sat regime there. At the other side, on these higher ones, you can show that it's unsat by basically bounding. Sort of, you bound what the number of ground states could be as you build up the graph, and you get some nice bounds on where a transition would be. But these bounds are not tight. 3.59 and this log 2 over 2 are not tight. They're just they're good bounds. And then what's the most interesting is that you can lower bound in the high k case, for k greater than about 12, the theorem applies, you can lower bound the number of ground states. This is the dimension of the zero energy subspace. Okay? And this is non-constructive. My product states were constructive. I could tell you how to find them even. This is non-constructive. All I know is that there is some dimensionality to this ground state space. But in fact, you can prove that this goes out to some clause density well beyond, it scales as 2 to the k over k squared, well beyond the 1 where the product states cease to appear. So this is now this, entangled sat phase, which is, I mean, this is something you can't have classically, and it's also potentially something that says this is a regime where it's really hard in a quantum sense rather than just a classical sense, and it may be hard even quantum mechanically to find these ground states. We don't know much more than that statement, really. that this regime exists. So how much time do I have?
3 minutes.
Well, yeah, so it's a question what that means, right? So the overall class of QSAT problems is QMA complete, but as soon as you put an ensemble on it, right? But this is, we hope, zooming in on the regime in this ensemble where some of the hardness is showing up. That's the idea. So, okay, I'm going to briefly flash this. I won't really explain it. So this is how you can characterize the product states on these models. Basically, the existence of product states is equivalent to the existence of dimer coverings on those interaction graphs that I showed you, and they're roughly in one-to-one correspondence. And this relies on some product state perturbation theory. It's sort of pretty, but just blow past it for now for the sake of time. And then the lower bound is based on this quantum Lobach local lemma, which is actually just sort of elementary. Ultimately, it's elementary counting Hilbert space sizes, dimensions of subspaces as you constrain them more and more. This was proven last year by Ambinus and coworkers. It's very nice. It basically tells you, well, you know if you have disconnected clusters, completely disconnected, that this has a satisfying ground state because it's not sufficiently interacting to be constrained. And the Lobach local lemma quantifies how much you can let these interactions overlap and still have some finite dimensional subspace left. So this is sort of, it's the classical version is a probabilistic statement. The quantum version is about relative dimension. Okay, so let me close with a few open questions about this. It's a rather long list. There are open questions about random QSAT generally. Where's the SAT on SAT phase transition? What's the, okay, so I didn't tell you what RG of G is. Actually, the question once you put these generic choices of projectors on the problem becomes essentially geometric in the sense that the choice of projector drops out with probability one. All the things we're trying to talk about right now are only depend on the interaction graph. And this function characterizes that, and it's not known whether that actually, that's a simplification. It's not known if that actually makes the problem classical or if it's still sort of quantum in some sense. Is this entanglement transition a thermodynamic transition in the ground state entropy? That would be very interesting because it's not really clear what entanglement means in this system. What about higher rank projectors? Well, I told you about rank one projectors. A lot of the stuff I told you generalizes naturally. There's been some people who've worked specifically on chains at higher rank, because if you take a chain, even though it's just sort of next neighbor interactions, and you go to higher rank, you can still get non-trivial entanglement properties. And then here's sort of the bigger picture things. Are there quantum analogs of this clustering dynamical phase transitions from the classical glass problem, that picture I showed you? Is there many body localization in this problem in some sense? Are there cavity methods? So all of the results I've given you actually don't use the cavity methods, which are integral for the classical story, and the replica symmetry breaking cavity methods. We don't know if it does, we haven't come up with one, some algorithm things. So let me just conclude with the bigger picture of what I started with, which is complexity theory. This is sort of why you should be interested, even if what you really want to do is you know, make your superconducting qubits work better. Okay, maybe you shouldn't, but anyway, complexity theory attempts to identify problems which are hard. Hard problems in this sense are unsolvable by any physical process under the assumption that, you know, there are hard problems. Such hardness results provide indirect existence proofs for glassy dynamics, slow dynamics, things that can't find their ground states, for instance, or other ways of encoding. Random ensembles of these complete problems, whether they're classically or quantumly so, provide direct insight into those features which may lead to hardness and slowdown, we hope. There's been a lot of work in that in the last 20 years. Phase transitions, clustering, replication, characteristics of the classical statistical treatments of SAT, and quantum SAT is a quantum hard problem whose random ensemble exhibits this new kind of clustered phase, if you allow me the liberty, that there's an entangled SAT phase. So let me just say this sort of broad level lecture, there are going to be Lesuch lecture notes which I wrote with mostly with Roeder, appearing on the archive in the next few days from a summer school he gave last summer. So anyway, thank you.
Any questions?
So one thing that often interests experimentalists is an observable. Mm-hmm. So the question is, as your system becomes larger, is an observable really going to depend on very, very subtle correlations? And can't we use sort of like a dynamical programming approach and eventually just cut it off at a certain amount of entanglement for an observable we can actually measure? Or do you really expect that these things are intensive?
So I think that's an interesting question, particularly for finite dimensional physics. So it's sort of a question about approximation. How well can I get things, right? So most of the results that are really the completeness results are, particularly for the finite dimensional models, are really about getting exactly the ground state, more or less. Classically, that's true. Quantumly, it's a little bit less clear, but it's roughly true. So if I can get close to the ground state and get some observables out, maybe by truncating some programming or just measuring things and seeing what happens, if it's getting close, maybe I can actually get close, right? I can get the observables in it and it has no consequence. But it's not clear that that would happen, one. And two is that, so then the flip argument is that in the finite dimensional case, I usually do have approximation. I can approximate things. So I told you this PCP theorem tells me that I can't get to even finite temperature, sort of not ground state properties, you know, or energies at least, in general. But the models which actually would exhibit that are very long range models that aren't limited by sort of short-range interactions. And I'm not sure if it's been studied actually, you know, whether physical interactions like Coulomb are long enough that they could do it. I sort of doubt it. I think it probably, you can still approximate. So then in the physical system, again, you don't actually have the sharp result. I don't have a particular thing that I can tell you. But at the same time, this would argue that, you know, there are going to be configurations of the system that I just can't access. And if somehow that involves a longer range correlation or something that I can't build up by cooling, I mean, that might be something that you would see. I don't know. It's very hand waving. Sorry.
So when you showed the phase diagram for classical SAT,
yeah,
you showed various transitions,
yep,
clustering, condensation. There's another one which is, you know, what's been called freezing transition. So when some variables take the same value in all clusters,
right,
in the solutions of a cluster.
Yeah.
So does this show up in any way, or does this have any implication from the quantum point of view?
I don't know. I know what you're talking. I don't know in the quantum in quantum SAT. I don't know, and I know that this is related to really where you find the hardest problems in the classical regime is when they get locked up, and I'm not really sure. And nobody's really studied. So the other thing that points to is that in the classical case, the big dirty secret, in fact, the range in which say 3 SAT or 4 SAT is hard is so small that you can almost not access it in any way. It's a very narrow sliver in alpha. And the problems which have regimes where this clustering picture actually seems to mean something in terms of dynamics of algorithms are much more locked up. And it's related to this freezing. But in the quantum case, nobody studied anything more locked up. We don't really know any. So.
Thanks.
You talked about the entanglement transition is what you mean, this prot-sat to sat-unprot-sat,
yeah,
transition?
Yeah.
Do you believe this is a transition? What would be the order parameter? Or does one know it?
Well, if you take the order parameter as the dimension of the zero energy subspace, then it's definitely... No, sorry, that didn't make any sense. That's right, I actually don't know. That's why I think it'd be interesting to calculate an entropy and see if you could have a transition in that. But calculating the entropy of the zero energy space is probably, you know, sharp P hard or something like that. There's some counting complexity class which is very hard. And you maybe can do it in these random ensembles, but I don't know how.
Well, and you would expect that this entropy drops or at the transition or what?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in general, the entropy is decreasing, and it seems reasonable to me that suddenly you could have a kink in it, because what's interesting about the prod set, unprod set thing is that in the product satisfiable regime, I know there are product state solutions. And in fact, in a lot of cases, although it doesn't completely generalize, it may be true on the random graphs, they span the zero energy space. But you can also construct examples which have product state solutions and then which have other states in them which just aren't spanned by product states at all. Okay. So if I cut out these product states, something's really changing in the way this is working. So whether it cuts out suddenly, you know, an exponential number, some entropic effect, I don't know. It'd be great to figure it out, but I don't know how to access it.
I'd like to ask a question about the possible quantum mechanical. Nope.
Sorry. Yeah, actually, it's very convenient. I wanted to ask a question about the same slide.
Yeah.
About possible quantum mechanical generalization. So that slide tells you two things. One says as you add constraints, the number of solutions drops, and maybe according to some law. But also, geometrically, it says that solutions are breaking up into clusters.
Right.
So that seems to make sense classically, but I don't know what the quantum mechanical analog of that would be, since in quantum mechanics, of course, you can take linear combinations. The subspaces aren't breaking up, but what is the quantum mechanical generalization of this picture?
So we've thought about this a bit. I think I don't have a complete answer. I think one thing you can look for is to try to find sort of bases of macroscopically distinct states, in the sense that I take this state and I take some other state and I put any operator, any local, bounded local operator I want in between them and look at that off-diagonal matrix element. And is that zero or exponentially small in system size? And that's actually getting at the idea, if I can do it for any bounded local operator, that's really getting at the idea of these states are macroscopically distinct. They would be cat states, because if I made a superposition, it would be some kind of cat state, because it's really different things, and anywhere I probe, I'd start picking one or the other. So in fact, one of the things we've tried to work out and not been able to make stick to anything is exactly how that might work. Could you, for instance, take a model, take this zero energy subspace, find an optimal basis in some sense, maybe orthonormal, maybe relax that a little bit, allow them to be exponentially close to orthogonal, which also has this property that all the states are as distinct as possible in terms of these bounded local operators. But I haven't made it stick. But I think that's what this would be getting at.
So a related question would be how do topological ground states fit in with this? These are states which are exponentially degenerate and also indistinguishable by local measurement. Sort of inverse question.
Yeah, so I'm not sure that it fits very well in this picture, because these dots represent entropic clusters of states, as opposed to just a couple. In terms of sort of distinctness, they would have, if you had two of these ground states, they wouldn't be connected by these local operators either. So, I mean, they would satisfy two topologic, I guess the two-dimensional subspace of topological, or whatever, some small dimensional subspace of topological ground states wouldn't be connected by these local operators either. So it would sort of also fit this definition that I had. But it's trying to probe something rather different here.
Physical glasses characterized by very slow dynamics.
Yeah. of actual physical quantum glasses?
Well, you could make your model and give it some regular dynamics in the unfolded state, which is not a problem.
Yeah, so I can't tell you anything other than conjecture, which would be that this would have in the entangled regime would also presumably have slow relaxational dynamics under something. But that's actually, I think in this picture, it would come from getting something like this clustering effect to hold in this quantum sense that local operators can't actually get you around. Slower. I'm not sure.
Well, no more questions. Well, thank you very much. Lunchtime.